Nerdette is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. Join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic HBO original limited series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Think on your feet for our Fast and Curious 5K, a one-of-a-kind race hosted by WBEZ and the Chicago Sun-Times on Saturday, July 27th at Humboldt Park. More info and early bird registration at wbez.org/events.
Hey friends, Greta here. Some of you may already be familiar with the very strange phenomenon known as Nerdette Recaps with Peter Sagal. It's the podcast where Nerdette co-host emeritus Trisha Bobita and I recapped Game of Thrones with Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me host Peter Sagal. I am very excited to announce that we are back, and this time we're going to talk all about movies of the 90s. So, here is our very first episode just for you. It's a recap of the 1995 classic rom-com starring Alicia Silverstone and Paul Rudd. It is called Clueless. It is based on a Jane Austen novel. It is great. This is the only one that we're going to put in the Nerdette feed. So if you like what you hear, you should like bop on over to Nerdette Recaps and subscribe to that wherever you get your pods. See you Friday.
We've been locked in with our dogs for 6 months now. But as the dogs like to say, you don't understand. I'm not locked in with you. You're locked in with me.
From WBEZ Chicago, this is Nerdette Recaps with Peter Sagal. I'm Trisha Bobita.
And I am Greta Johnson. And we are here, of course, with our friend who we love to hate, Peter Sagal.
And I hate to love you, but it's helpless. I can't help it. It's great to see you guys, even on this Zoom screen.
Okay, so we are going to be recapping 90s movies, but I've heard of at least one person who did not watch Game of Thrones along with us or his Dark Materials. So this is like their first foray into recaps. Peter, can you help for listeners who are joining us for the first time? Like, what are they in for?
Well, this all began some years ago when we were all working together at WBEZ and we all realized that we liked Game of Thrones, and you guys, in a remarkable act of charity, gave me a vehicle in which I could gas on about it almost endlessly without alienating everybody I work with.
Yeah, it was really a favor we were doing for your colleagues and yes, family members who were tired of listening to you talk about Game of Thrones.
Exactly, and I'm very grateful, and we ended up talking about four whole seasons
of
Game of
Thrones. And then we tired of you talking about Game of Thrones.
Exactly. That was the challenge. Can I make them as sick of me as everyone else is? And we talked about Game of Thrones with great pleasure and occasional fireworks for a few years, and we discovered that basically, you know, the real Game of Thrones was the friends we made along the
yes,
way, and we wanted to continue to argue about things and appreciate things together, so we did a season of His Dark Materials on HBO, and then we decided it would be fun to do these movies that we all saw, but at very different times of our lives, because I am old enough to be your grandfather.
I can't believe that I'm about to say these words aloud. I agree with Peter.
We thought we'd start with the nice one.
Thank you. It'll go downhill from here. I should say, again, if there are any new listeners, that is what we call patriarchy jingles, and they were composed and performed for us by Paul and Storm, who are friends of mine, or at least they were before they did all these jingles.
Definitely friends of ours now.
Yes.
Okay, so today we are going to recap Clueless, which is a high school rom-com. It came out in 1995. It stars most notably Alicia Silverstone and Paul Rudd. Alicia plays Cher Horowitz, who's like a ridiculously wealthy white girl in Beverly Hills who loves to negotiate better grades for herself and meddle in other people's lives. This also seems like a good point to mention that it's actually an adaptation of Jane Austen's 1815 novel, Emma. Oh, Peter, those pups are really going, huh?
That's my... Yeah, Matt's Dee Dee saying she really prefers the aesthetic of Heathers. Shut up, Dee Dee.
So I think we should start by getting the context. Speaking of like actually back in the 90s, like when both of you actually saw this movie for the first time. Peter, let's start with you.
I did not see this movie when it came out, unlike most of the other movies we're talking about, because I really didn't like high school movies.
Yeah.
Like many people who end up in public radio, high school was not the highlight of my life. And I couldn't imagine wanting to like spend up to 2 hours reliving somebody else's version of it. So I avoided most, if not all, of the great high school movies of the 80s and 90s. Like, I never saw any of the, like, the Pretty in Pink or the John Hughes movies.
None of the John Hughes?
Nope. Skipped them all.
That's especially interesting since they're set in Chicago, and you were in Chicago for most of this
time,
right?
I absolutely know. It was just this weird aversion.
So this was like a very much an aversion, not an
accidental
missing of the
movies. Yeah, and please do not misunderstand. It's not like I'm above high school movies or I think they're dumb or something like that. It's just like they bring up trauma that I wasn't particularly interested in reliving.
So when did you actually see it?
That is a really good question. I had seen it before. It was a long time ago because watching it this week, there were a lot of things I didn't remember. But it was, I would guess it was probably on videotape sometime in the late 90s, early 2000s. I just was like, I should probably watch this movie that everybody keeps referencing.
I think for reference also, Peter, you should tell us what years you were in high school.
Oh, yes. Mm. I am a proud graduate and member of the class of 1983 of Governor Livingston High School in Berkeley Heights, New Jersey. Shout out to the Highlanders.
Oh, boy.
I know. And let me ask you, too, how old were you in 1983, Tricia?
I would be born 4 years later.
There you
in 1987.
Are. Okay. And Greta?
Yeah, my parents were seniors in college. I was born in 1985.
Exactly. So there we are.
Yeah.
good level set. Yeah. Good level set, everybody.
Okay, so Tricia, what about you?
I saw this movie for the first time last night.
And no. What did you think?
I mean, I understand why it's beloved, for sure. I have some questions, a couple of suggestions, as Aaron Burr would say to George Washington. I've been listening to a lot of Hamilton, so that's just going to happen accidentally, and I might have to call it out later.
Some traditions will never die.
No, I mean, I don't know exactly why either. I didn't see it on video before this. My mom contends that maybe I did and have just completely forgotten it. But Paul Rudd is too cute in this movie to have completely forgotten the movie, I think. So I think I really didn't see it until last night on Netflix. And I think, you know, similar to Peter, it wasn't a genre that I often sought out. So, like, obviously I saw all the John Hughes movies and some other things along the way. But I have a feeling that because, particularly like the cover of this movie at the Blockbuster or the local video store, mm-hmm. would have been sort of so pink and polished and preppy looking, that was just not my vibe, mm-hmm. really. I probably didn't realize that it was like a really smart satire on class and the way that Jane Austen is, mm-hmm. which I do now. But at the time, I think I thought it was just going to be a silly rom-com about a really pretty girl who didn't really have any problems.
Which it kind of is.
Yeah, but it's aware of that. Right. And the fact that it's aware of that is what makes it, I think, something that lasts and something cool. I also probably didn't realize at the time and appreciate now that it's directed and written by a woman, which again means that it's going to just be more nuanced as a story about young women than probably a lot of other movies at this time were.
Yeah.
It's also a movie directed by a woman who had previously directed Fast Times at Ridgemont High, mm-hmm. which is another Southern,
Amy Heckerling.
Which is another Southern California high school movie, which is a lot different in tone, and which I did see. And it's interesting to think like she made Fast Times at Ridgemont High, which was, if not exactly realistic, at least more set in the real world. There's that whole important plot about these two people having sex and one getting pregnant and what happens after that. And then she went to make this movie, which takes place in this fantasy version of Beverly Hills, where they attend Bronson Alcott High School, where nothing bad ever happens to anyone except for a cartoonish-like mugging. And you have to, and it's interesting to wonder, it's like, why did she want to do this? Why did she want to make a movie with such a different tone?
I also love that almost every character's first name is that of a famous recording artist. Which some of them are stolen from the book, right? Like Elton is a name in Emma.
Yes.
But then obviously Cher is not. So.
Dion and I were both named after great singers of the past who now do infomercials.
Yep.
It's so funny to me because I feel like of the three of us, I've definitely seen the fewest movies just as a person who didn't really grow up watching movies. And I can't remember exactly if I saw Clueless actually in the theater or just shortly thereafter, but I definitely saw it like as a 10-year-old.
Yeah.
Which was a really interesting time to have seen it because like the satire stuff, a lot of it totally went over my head.
Right? Yeah.
You know, which I think like I wonder the extent to which Clueless is problematic, because I think for a lot, I could picture for a lot of kids my age seeing it, wanting to aspire to being a Cher, you know, and having right. the closet with the magical computer interface and the beautiful house and, you know, calorie counting and all of that stuff. It's like, I do wonder how much it actually did perpetuate some of those like super problematic behaviors, you know?
Yeah, I think it's definitely a movie with those different layers. And so I was trying to think last night, like, how would I have reacted to this movie as a teenager? Mm-hmm. And I think it probably would have gone over my head, that stuff, at the time. And so I would have kind of maybe rolled my eyes through most of it. Although it's pretty fun,
it's
too,
funny.
Right? Like, it's pretty
yeah.
well done. It moves along. I mean, I think, you know, the sleeper stars of the movie are definitely Wallace Shawn and his love story.
Wallace Shawn is the guy who says inconceivable a lot in Princess Bride and is in Toy Story and a great many other movies as well.
Yeah. By the way, Wallace Shawn is half of one of my favorite celebrity couples, Wallace Shawn and Deborah Eisenberg, the great writer. But so it was fun also to just kind of like watch this movie and scene by scene see people who I know and love from so many other things, some of whom were established at this point, many of whom got probably their start in this movie.
I mean, this was Paul Rudd's first full-length movie.
Right.
Yeah.
And he has not aged a day since.
Not aged a day.
And scientists should study
it. It's really weird. I just want to point out that the Wallace Shawn's love interest, Miss Geist, is played by a woman named Twink Kaplan. I just wanted to point that out.
Oh,
that's her name.
Great.
It's a great name.
Here's a question for you guys.
You know what? We actually, before we get to your question, can we listen to a voicemail? Because we actually got one
from
Danny about Wallace Shawn.
I love that Wallace Shawn is in this movie because I feel like his character and Alicia Silverstone's character are like on two different planets. And it also makes me think, like, what was a teenage Wallace Shawn like? This is a question that keeps me up at night all the time. He had a famous father, and certainly there is probably some stuff out there of him as a teenager, and I'd like to see it.
I am guessing that Wallace Shawn had the kind of high school experience that probably made him not want to watch high school movies. Just guessing.
But I also think that like Paul Rudd, Wallace Shawn has not really aged, but he just
that's
started
true.
At that particular
yeah,
age
he's
difference. In this movie. Like, I bet at 16 he looked exactly like he does in Clueless,
right.
And he kind of looks like that now.
No,
so
both of them sold their soul
thing.
To the devil to never age, but Paul Rudd was smart enough to specify what age he wanted to be stuck at. Let me ask you guys a question. Is this because something Trisha raised, and this is actually one of the reasons that it's fun to talk about these movies because of how different our ages were when we saw them, whenever we saw them. Is this a kid's movie? Is this a movie for like preteens about a fantasy version of high school that's fun and delightful and the problems that arise are solvable? And friends will be there for you, even if you occasionally have tension. I mean, it's a movie in which even sex isn't particularly threatening or scary. It's this lovely world, which I guess reflects Austin a lot. She was writing about mm-hmm. this wonderful sort of pleasant, I don't know what you want to call it, almost like biosphere of pleasantness in the country where nothing bad happened, no one was hungry, and there's no violence or anything like that. And maybe that's really appealing to people, to think that life is going to be like that.
It's a little bit like waiting for your Hogwarts letter. It's like, can something else this magical and different from what I'm experiencing exist? Maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe the only, you know, it's right around the corner. I mean, I think the thing that I appreciate about it, they're definitely, Greta, like you said, are those problematic things where it doesn't really, in the way a 2020 movie maybe hopefully might, would challenge the idea of, you know, the sort of very intense calorie counting that Cher is doing and some of these other body image issues and that kind of thing. Like mm-hmm. you would hope that maybe some of those would be more complicated. But the movie very bluntly, because of the way it's narrated, says, oh, instead of giving people makeovers of their faces, I'm going to make over my soul. Like, it's a very on the nose, which to me, that kind of dialogue is for kids. Like, to say it that bluntly means that it's meant for a young audience. And so that is kind of the point of the movie, right?
Well,
is
that's what
she thinks that she's perfect, and so she has all the wisdom. And then she realizes, like, oh, I should try to be a better person, not just better looking.
I think, Trisha, that's actually, like, the pivot point in the movie is when, because she's meddling with everybody else, right? She's trying to fix
right.
everybody else, and then she realizes that instead she should try to fix herself. Which I think,
yeah.
like, I think it's actually really interesting to consider it as like a subversive makeover movie because especially into the rest of the 90s and even now, there are so many, you know, like She's All That is the perfect example, right? Isn't that the one? With like, you know, you take off her glasses and you take her hair out of the ponytail and then she's pretty. And then all of a sudden.
Oh, yeah. A straightener and some contacts and then
Freddie Prinze Jr. will love her. Right. And like it actually and they try to do that a little bit with Mrs. Geis. But for the most part, that's not actually part of the movie, which is kind of wonderful, I think, you know.
It is true. I remember there was almost a literal, oh, my God, take off your glasses. You're beautiful moment with Miss Geist, which I make fun of so often, it's rare to actually see one.
Oh, they're there.
They're there.
Let's listen to... Justin, can we listen to the montage you made of voicemails?
Hi, Nerdette. This is Marie from Fort Collins.
Hi, Nerdette. This is Camila from Atlanta, Georgia.
This is Bridget. Long-time listener, first-time caller.
The fact that you are doing your first new one about Clueless is just extra exciting for me.
I absolutely adore Clueless.
We used to be obsessed with that movie. Like, it was a staple of my childhood.
There's something about the relationship between Cher, Dion, and Ty that when I saw it as a 9 or 10-year-old, I was like, oh, this is what, you know, grown-up girl friendships are supposed to be like. And I've kind of held on to that in my adulthood.
And living in Colombia, we used to be obsessed with the Valley Girl accent and we would try to imitate the way they say things.
They're so supportive of each other. They call each other out, but ultimately they're just, you know, they're there for each other.
I am a little weirded out about Paul Rudd as the stepbrother rather than close family friend. And I think it would have been improved if they somehow clarified that those two never really lived together.
Hot as you are, Paul Rudd, you are still in college and she is still 16. Not appropriate ever, ever, ever.
When I mentioned to my daughter that I was watching the movie, she even said, oh, gross, that's the one where she ends up with her brother.
And also the ex-stepbrother thing is also weird. But you know what? Ultimately, it's a movie. And the good messaging wins out.
Thanks so much for bringing the podcast back. We missed it so much.
I will say that the one thing I remembered from whenever I saw it many years ago was, yeah, is this the movie where the nice blonde girl ends up kissing her brother?
Yeah, that was one of my questions.
Briefly on that, one of the things this movie made me do after I saw it the other night was to start reading Emma again, which I did.
Oh,
so
cool.
I've now read the first 60 or 70 pages of Emma over again. I'm an Austin expert by my standards. And it turns out that
I mean, that gets a jingle, right?
Yeah, I know. Come on, that was self-mocking, though.
If Peter's opinion falls in the forest, does anybody give a shit?
I mean, you're mocking, but you are about to give an opinion of Emma, which you've read 60 pages of.
Recently. Yes, I read it.
Yeah.
But one of the things I was curious about was whether that aspect, this weird familiar relationship, is in the book. And it is. Mr. Knightley, who is the Paul Rudd of Emma.
It's much more problematic in the book, age-wise.
It's very much, they're 16 years apart.
Everything's more problematic age-wise in 1850.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. although Emma is 21, which makes everything a little bit better.
Mm.
Mr. Knightley, the same figure, same kind of character, is, if you follow her, it took me a second, her brother-in-law's brother. So the brother of the man that married Emma's sister. So they have the same kind of, it's not as weirdly quasi-incestuous as stepbrother. But, you know, I think the whole point is there's this guy who's around for reasons that are not at all romantic or potentially romantic.
And they've known each other since she was a child.
Yeah, they've known each other for years, and they're very hostile. Oh, Mr. Knightley is so much meaner to Emma and so much more overt in his, you are an idiot, than Paul Rudd is to Alicia Silverstone. It's quite something. In a weird way, and this is the last thing I'll say because I only read 60 pages, Austin is much more critical of Emma than Amy Heckerling is of Cher. Emma comes across as someone who's not only clueless, but almost malicious. She hurts people to do what she wants, which she thinks is for the better good. It's really quite something.
And I don't know if y'all saw the 2020 Emma adaptation that came out, but I thought it was terrible. And partly it was because I just couldn't stand Emma. And I am not like an Emma person. You know, I have friends who have like, you know, they'll go back to the Gwyneth Paltrow version and are obsessed with this story. But yeah, I think Emma is generally pretty unlikable the way she meddles. And it's something that Amy Heckerling talked about, was that she really wanted to make Emma more likable, which reminds me of a voicemail we got from Caroline here in Chicago. Caroline actually writes for the AV Club. And she wrote an article in July for Clueless's 25th anniversary about how this is the best Austin adaptation.
Hey, Nerdette. This is Caroline Sita from the AV Club in Chicago. So one thing people can miss about Jane Austen's work is that in addition to her romantic aims, she was also writing these hilarious social satires about England's landed elite. And what's so great about Clueless is that it takes all of that satire of Austen's Emma and makes it totally relatable for a modern audience, you know, without the period clothing and the old-fashioned language. It's just so much easier to see that this story is kind of lovingly making fun of a wealthy world where people are self-involved and totally unaware of their own privilege. And so even though Austen's novels have gotten more straightforward adaptations over the years, including actually a very good version of Emma that was released earlier this year, Clueless is still one of the best because it makes Austen's sneaky sense of humor totally accessible for a modern audience, which I think is something she really would have loved.
I think A, she's right, and B, I wish people could have seen the face that Greta just made when when the subject of the recent Emma adaptation came up.
Man, I just really hate it. And, you know, we heard from someone else, I think it was Marie in Fort Collins. She said Clueless was great, and she would have said that was the best Emma adaptation until this most recent one came out. I just thought it was like, I don't know, I just found it extremely unlikable. I think it tried too hard to be whimsical, but still felt really stiff, and it was just sort of like, and who knows, like maybe that actually hews really closely to the source text. I've never actually read Emma, but it was just like, this is an unpleasant film.
I was looking around for a copy of the book online to read. I don't have a copy, I'm sorry. I did find a note that apparently this was Austen's last novel published in her lifetime. And apparently she said to herself in her own journal, she said, I think I'd like to try to write about a character I dislike. So she set out to write someone who ultimately gets redeemed, but who was really kind, more than kind of awful. And Knightley says to Emma all the time, you are awful. You have just sabotaged not only this, when she manipulates the breakup of a relationship because she thinks that her friend deserves someone better, she like not only ruins the best possibility for her friend, she destroys this poor man's feelings, and she just does it utterly blithely, which is something we don't really see Cher do, right?
And I think even that difference, I mean, you know, age meant different things, I think, in the 1800s, as you're saying, but even the difference between being 16 and 21 as a character.
Yeah.
Like, we expect 16-year-olds to be pretty naive about the world, especially, I think, in a pre-internet age where, like, you really were living in whatever bubble you were in, and there wasn't that much access to other information. Fun fact that I learned researching the internet's knowledge of Clueless last night, because that is my job.
I did feel bad about taking you know, getting into your turf as I was researching things on the internet. Just so you know, for sure.
But that, you know, some of the things that she mispronounces, that Cher mispronounces,
Haitian?
Yeah, like that Haitian instead of Haitian, she just didn't know how to say Haitian, and Amy Heckerling was like, no one tell her, because she thought it was perfect. But it was really earnest, and just she didn't know that word. And Alicia Silverstone has also said, like, I'm embarrassed that I didn't know that, but also I was a teenager, and I didn't know all the things.
Right, and she's one of the only ones who's actually a teenager in the movie. She and Brittany Murphy, I believe, are sort of the only ones in the core cast who are, like, actually teenagers when they filmed it. Because, you know, so often with those high school movies, you see it all the time, even like with Riverdale or whatever these days.
The 35-year-old high school sophomore.
Exactly. Yeah. There's like 15 years of difference between the person playing the high schooler and the person playing the parent, you know.
Let me ask you guys another question. I asked if this was a kid's movie. Is this a woman's movie? Is this a movie that is... No, seriously.
Can we jingle that?
I don't know.
Nobody cares, but it never really stops him. Is Peter still fucking talking?
Right. Okay. All of the voicemails that you just played were all from women. And and most of the people...
Danny. Don't forget Danny.
Yeah, Danny at the top. Almost all. And like, my wife loved this movie. She said she and her girlfriends in, like, she has the same set of friends all through elementary school, junior high, and high school. They're still friends. They just loved this movie. They watched it all the time. They referenced it. And I have not heard as many men talk about this movie that way. Although men I know love it. But it seems to be a movie. Well, tell me if I'm wrong. Is it aimed toward women? Is it particularly the first call you played, in which it said, "This is what female relationships should be like. They're supportive. They call each other out, but everything works out. They're there for each other." That is really attractive, and
that's a 2020 squad sort of approach to friendship too. Yeah, I mean, I think this movie was definitely designed for young women. I don't think that there's any question that that's who it was for. I mean, everything about it, from the way it was packaged to, again, like who was on the cover, all that kind of thing. And just in general, right? I think the industry thinks of romantic comedies as movies that are geared and marketed towards women, and then the men who watch them are sort of secondary. Not that movies are meant to necessarily exclude those people, but they do have a target audience. And a rom-com starring a teenage girl is meant for and marketed for teenage girls, I think. And probably in some cases, girls even younger than the characters, right? Because there's that aspirational thing where, like, teenage stuff is actually for, like, 11-year-olds, because actual 16-year-olds might kind of roll their eyes at it by that point, potentially.
I think you're totally right, Tricia. I think, and the fact that it's, like, written and directed by a woman also. Yeah. I think the thing that bums me out about the question, Peter, is that for so long, so many things were made by men for men that women had to just, like, figure out how to like, because nothing else existed. That it bums me out that dudes don't seem to have the same interest in putting themselves in other people's shoes.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean?
You're absolutely right. When my kids were little, and I used to complain about,
like,
the fact,
finding books with lady protagonists, even 20 years ago, was really difficult.
Absolutely. And that's one of the reasons why I really was interested in doing His Dark Materials, because it's like the great female protagonist that young men, boys, are said, you now need to do what women have been asked to do for centuries and put yourself in the shoes of an opposite sex character. That's great. But at the same time, you can make a woman's movie for women, and it can be a really positive thing. You can speak to women's interests. You can speak to women's concerns. You can speak to, in the same way that there are, again, countless movies, every movie, that are about male concerns and male wish fulfillment and setting characters in a world that men want to live in. Isn't it okay if that's in fact what
but
this
those
is?
Those are just called movies. Oh, I think that's the part that, like, gets me, you know?
I totally get it. But when I say, is it a woman's movie, I'm genuinely not trying to diminish it or put it in, like, a subcategory.
Yes.
I'm actually saying, is this a movie that was intended to appeal to women in particular? And if so, it seems like it really succeeded.
And it seems like that's what Amy Heckerling was trying to do, right? Was to create something in this genre that was often movies that were kind of bad and superficial and didn't have the layers that Clueless does. And she was like, I'm going to use all the trappings of this genre. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to, like, just go make sort of like a dark indie movie that no one will watch. I'm going to make it a movie that people will go see.
Mm-hmm.
And the clothes are going to be incredible. And the cast is going to be beautiful. But then I'm going to say something while I'm doing it.
Right.
And that was something, like, that was her sort of stealthy way of making a movie that had more layers, as she knew she had to sort of put makeup on it to get it through the Hollywood system, and then she could say something with the movie too.
Yeah,
totally.
Which I think is kind of cool.
You know what? I think this is a great time to actually listen to a clip that we pulled of. This is shortly after Ty, the new girl, shows up, and Cher and Dion are kind of, like, giving her the tour of the different cliques. They're, like, walking through campus at lunchtime.
Yes, this is great.
It's so good.
Cher's got attitude about high school girls.
It's a personal choice every woman has got to make for herself.
Woman, let me $5.
Murray, I have asked you repeatedly not to call me woman.
Excuse me, Miss Dion.
Thank you.
Okay, but street slang is an increasingly valid form of expression. Most of the feminine pronouns do have mocking, but not necessarily misogynistic undertone.
Wow. You guys talk like grown-ups.
Oh, well, this is a really good school.
I just think it's so perfect.
Donald
Peter,
Faison.
That actually speaks to your, like, is this a woman's movie too, right? You can use a female pronoun and it doesn't necessarily have a misogynistic undertone.
That clip also brings up something I wanted to ask you guys about, because I don't know what to say, which is the weird racial politics with Dion and her boyfriend. One of the things I found out doing my Trisha impression and doing research was that Paul Rudd was asked to audition for the movie, and he wanted to audition for the role of Dion's boyfriend. Murray, I think his name is. Because he read the dialogue in the script, and he's like, well, this is clearly a white person trying to adopt black culture, and it's a satire of that guy, right? Because black people don't actually talk this way, right? How did that play to you? I mean, in a weird way, when I think his name is Murray, when he first appears and he's got the whole thing going on with the whole sort of street look,
the pants,
and you're like, oh God, are they going to engage in this stereotype? Oh my God, I can't, this is going to make me cringe. But then it turns out that the character himself is totally aware of what he's doing. Like, he is fronting this. And as we just heard in that bit of dialogue, which is, I think, the first time we meet him, he instantly shows how incredibly aware he is of what he's doing and why he's doing it. And all of a sudden it becomes, like with so many other things in this movie, including Cher's materialism and her dumbness and their superficiality, the movie knows.
Right. The movie knows.
It's like, yeah, we know. And these people are still wonderful. And yet look how silly they are. And I thought that made it all okay.
Well, and again, to Amy Heckerling's credit, to have black characters at all in this movie was kind of a big deal at the time. Not that that's you know, something that we can just applaud and not question how it was done, but most of these movies, these John Hughes movies, these sort of high school rom-com movies, very often are almost completely white cast, or there's like one token, you know, person of color who's usually not a main character at all and kind of a best friend or a punchline. I mean, co-stars of this movie, obviously the movie is mostly about Cher. We're in Cher's head as a narrator for most of it. But this trio of best friends, including Stacey Dash's character, and then having some of the smartest and funniest and most interesting stuff happening with these two characters who are black in a movie that, again, would have been marketed to white audiences at this time especially, is, I think, a bit progressive in and of its own right. But yeah, their relationship on its own is problematic because it's all performative and it's all, you know, kind of terrifyingly shallow at the beginning, especially. And then it seems to evolve and Cher sees it for being something deeper later on when she's like, oh, they're actually really considerate when no one's looking. Well, that's a weird way to have a relationship.
Yeah.
And
well,
again,
and even
they're 16.
Like, the first description you have of the two of them, they're fighting, and Cher says something about how they're like Ike and Tina Turner, which
is
just
one of those,
like, very cringeworthy
lines. Certain things
line,
have,
you know,
changed.
Like,
we don't make jokes about that anymore.
Yeah. You know, so yeah, it's not perfect, we'll just say.
One thing, though, that struck me immediately and stayed true throughout the movie, which is, like, all the best satires, the people who made this one really love the people they're satirizing. And you can tell the difference. I recently watched Heathers, which I haven't seen also in many years, which is another high school movie from more or less the same period. And the tone...
Oh, man. I saw Heathers for the first time like a year ago, and I was like, I wonder what kind of different person I would have been if I had actually seen this as a high schooler. It was so good.
And Heathers is a little tough to watch these days because it's much more overtly about things that we generally don't find funny anymore, like teen suicide. But...
Did we think that was funny?
I believe me, that's a movie I did see in the theater, and it was a sensation.
Well, I mean, to be fair, in Clueless, there's a teen suicide joke.
There is where?
Right.
Yeah, when, what's his...
Travis
Birkenstock?
Window?
What is his
name
in real life? He's like the 90s
Yeah, he sort of claims when he gets
his bad
grade and he
grade,
clambers
and
up
so
and Wallace Shawn just says, no.
But it's a first story... It's clearly like a first story classroom, I believe. Or maybe it's supposed to be Treetops, but yeah.
But I mean, it's still a teen suicide joke, just as an example of, you know.
But the difference in many ways... There are a lot of differences in the movies. One of which is that in Heathers, there's a real hostility towards some of the characters that's almost uncomfortable. Like, these people are terrible and they deserve to die. That's the joke of the movie. And it watching it now, it made me uncomfortable. And that's something, maybe because I'm old and sentimental now, it's just something it's hard for me to handle when a movie is about people who the makers of the movie dislike in some way. And
well, I think that's one thing that does stand out about Clueless is that, like, and I think it's designed that way. You know, you mentioned the mugging, which would legitimately be scary. But for the most part, the stakes aren't that high in this movie at all.
Which is very Austin.
And nobody's that mean to each other either. You know, even comparing it to like a Gossip Girl or something like that, where like somebody's going to ruin everything for everybody. Yeah. Like, most people mostly mean well in this movie, which makes it just like kind of a pleasure to spend time
in. As opposed to Heathers, where they're actually murdering people.
Exactly. Okay, let's take a break and then we'll talk more about Clueless in just a minute.
Ew, get off of me. Ugh, as if.
Let's listen to Danny. Actually had another thought that I think is a really good one.
Hey, this is Danny from Washington, D.C. So great to rewatch this movie. I love Clueless. And I had some things that I noticed that I had not noticed before. I love Paul Rudd reading Nietzsche, Christian reading William S. Burroughs, Cher and Ty reading Women Are From Venus, Men Are From Mars, and Fit or Fat. Just a lot of good literacy going on in this movie. I also love that Paul Rudd is introduced with the Benz era Radiohead, and that that album plays throughout the movie like four times. And I think Dion refers to it as complaint rock, which is excellent music criticism. Yeah. I love the Valley speak. Wasn't my mom a total Betty is a great line. Made me laugh really hard. And I have a question, which is, would you want to go to this high school? You know, maybe like I wasn't cool or whatever in high school, but there seems to be a lot of social pressure that I don't think I'd be comfortable with. I mean, I guess everyone kind of turns out fine, but it seems like a stressful place to go to high school. Everyone is very wealthy. Okay, well, those are my thoughts. I love this movie, and I'm excited to listen to the podcast.
I was thinking about why the high school is named Branson Alcott High School. Like, out of all the fake names, why that one? And it may be because this was Branson Alcott, am I getting the name right? Was the father of Louisa May Alcott, and he was one of those 19th century utopians. He tried to set up an ideal society, and like they all did, they all failed. And maybe that's the reference. Like, this is this utopia. Because frankly, I'd love to go to this high school where everybody is happy and rich and the parties are great and there's no real hostility. I mean, the clickiness is there, but it's fine. Everybody's fine.
Nobody's trying to murder anybody.
There isn't even any drink or drug use, right? I mean, is anybody getting hammered at the party?
Not really.
They're drinking and they're like, they're drinking beers. There's a reference to wine drinking, which is dangerous because it makes people feel sexy.
Well, and you remember the Coke line, right? Did you guys catch that?
Yeah, you guys got Coke?
You got it. You got anything herbal for me?
Right.
I could really use some sort of an herbal refreshment.
Oh, well, we do lunch in 10 minutes. We don't have any tea, but we have Coke and stuff.
No shit, you guys got Coke here?
Yeah,
this is America.
But it's all pretty, very mild. Mild drug, you know, it's like they say in the warnings for audiences, mild drug use. It's mild drug use. And it just seems lovely.
As they, I think, say about weed, even, they're like, to light one up at a party is one thing, but to be baked all day is quite another. You know, it's just like, even that, it's like, they're not like anti-drug, but they're not like pro-stoner. Yeah. It's like a kind of interesting middle ground they've struck. I also resemble the remark when they're going through the cliques. It's like, those are the kids who work for the TV station, the school TV station. They take themselves very seriously. It's like, oh, I resemble that remark. That was me in high school.
I mean,
I was not in high school. I was covering high school as a journalist. Thank you very much.
You were there as an observer. You were not participating.
Yes.
Ethics required that you played no role in there.
That's why I never went to any parties, Peter. It would have been unethical.
It would have been contravention to the ethical responsibilities of a journalist to socialize with your subjects. Oh, you and me, sister.
I also think for the mid-90s, especially, the way that this movie handles having a gay character is pretty awesome. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
that, you know, there's the really problematic Murray description of, don't you guys realize he's gay? And he kind of riffs on all these
famous and old style nicknames.
Yeah, friend of Dorothy kind of references. Mm-hmm. But then instead of her being mad at him for maybe stringing her along or being upset that he's gay just because she's homophobic, they become good friends. And so I think a lot of my gay guy best friends also loved this movie because, as some of them put it, like, it just made it a little bit more okay to maybe come out in high school because it was like, oh, here's a vision of what could happen. You could just end up with great friends and go dancing on the weekends and dance with your girlfriends and then also get to flirt with boys. And that seemed like probably a magical, ideal version of what being 16 and gay in 1995 looked like.
Oh, God, yeah, that's absolutely right. And I remember I was watching the movie, and again, I didn't remember it well, and they're dropping all these big hints that that character is gay. I love the fact that he wants to watch Spartacus, the scene with Laurence Olivier and Tony Curtis.
He loves Tony Curtis.
And my stomach started to knot up as I was anticipating the incredibly awkward, embarrassing scene where he confesses that he's gay. And I imagined he'd be embarrassed or whatever, and it would be really awkward for Cher because she didn't know.
Yeah.
And instead, just like you said, Trisha, a third person says, no, he's gay. Don't you know that? Aren't you being clueless? And then the next thing you know, they're pals. And not only are they pals, and it's totally great, but the next thing that that character gets to do in the movie is do something really great for Ty.
He helps Ty from
falling off. And he helps Ty with physical courage, by the way. Which is
again a gay male character who gets to be masculine and a hero. Yes.
Yeah,
that's
he's not like the gay best friend who helps her pick out an outfit or gives a relation. He goes over and he takes care of the bullies, which
that's
is
really
like, yay, that is amazing. Yeah. And I can
that's
so
cool.
see that, all those gay kids who weren't able to say come out and watching that and going, that's the life I wish I lived.
So something we haven't discussed that has been on my list is the sandwich thing.
What?
Which y'all did not pick up on, right?
In all my notes, the word sandwich does not appear.
Okay, so...
Yes, mine either.
So Ty comes over to Cher's house, and Cher is, like, explaining all the things she needs to do. And Josh, Paul Rudd, comes in and is sort of watching, and then Josh goes into the kitchen, Cher follows him, Josh makes a sandwich. But the way he does it is he pulls out these two pieces of bread, he takes a piece of turkey, puts it on the bread, and then he puts mayonnaise on the turkey and then puts the bread on top and starts eating it. And I wrote down, I was like, what is this weird ass order of operations with this sandwich?
Really? Of all the things in this movie, this is the one you came loaded for bear for?
Who puts the mayonnaise on the fucking meat like that? Like, you don't, nobody does that. So I Googled it.
Oh my God.
And I'm very happy to report that this website called goat.com, which is like it might be Australian, it's definitely a gossip website. They had this headline, the one scene from Clueless that still makes Paul Rudd cringe. And apparently this came up during last year's comic convention here in Chicago.
Yes, it happened here.
And when Paul was asked by an audience member if he had any advice to give to his younger self while filming the movie, he said, and I quote, when I go to the kitchen and I make the sandwich, I would put the mayonnaise on the bread and knock directly onto the turkey itself. And then he said, I was so nervous with the filming of that scene, I just put the mayonnaise on the turkey. Now when I see the scene, it's like nails on a chalkboard.
Wow.
Oh, that's funny.
Isn't that hilarious?
It seems that you're Paul Rudd's soulmate. Go to him, Greta. Both of you
are
so bothered
by this. I would not be mad about that at all, Peter.
I mean, speaking of Paul Rudd and cringeworthy, should we unpack for a moment what some of our voicemail givers have? Which is, he's in college. They didn't grow up as siblings, right? They weren't like together from a young age, living next, in rooms next to each other, like living as siblings, it seems like. Mm-hmm. But he's still at least several years older. And, I mean, in the first scene of the movie, calls her dad.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is the incestuous vibe right there.
That's a little incesty.
Yeah.
That's a little weird, right?
Oh, it's definitely
But we
weird.
Just were okay with it because he's real cute? Like, what? How? What?
I mean, what? I feel like any good, especially a rom-com from the 90s, requires like a certain degree of suspension of disbelief.
Yes, especially this one.
You know, and yeah, it's like you kind of just have to not think about certain things too hard, and I think that's just one of
but
them.
But that's what
that's
do.
What she
I
does.
Think about things too
I know,
hard.
Buddy, I know.
And then that's her whole brand, then I write Greta. About them for the school paper.
Let's listen. We actually have a couple more Paul Rudd voicemails that I think are very important. Let's listen to Jennifer from Winnipeg.
Hi, Nerdette. It's Jen calling again from Winnipeg. I just called you about my nerdy road trip, but I had to call again because I love Clueless. I squealed when I saw that you were doing the 90s movie recaps. I actually didn't see Clueless in 95. I only saw it a few years ago because I somehow signed up for the Paul Rudd advent calendar where they send you a picture of Paul Rudd every day for December. It's quite delightful. If you haven't signed up, you should. So then one year I got my Paul Rudd advent calendar, decided I should watch Clueless, then decided I had to read Emma and watch Emma. So now every year at Christmas, I watch Clueless and I watch Emma. This is why Clueless and Emma are my favorite Christmas movies. And I am so glad you're doing it. And I cannot wait to hear it on Wednesday. Bye.
Paul Rudd advent calendar sounds pretty.
Could you guys, because I like Paul Rudd. He's very charming. He's very funny. Is he adorable? Is he like somebody who's makes women's hearts go swoon?
He is a babe. Yeah.
Okay.
And just like even seeing him like wearing all black, reading Nietzsche by the pool, like, and I get that he is not a perfect character in this movie, but I think he's hilarious. And I think the fact that he like he respects Cher's intelligence in a way that actually very few other people in this movie do, I think.
Right.
You know, like there's that scene where he picks her up after she gets mugged and there's the other girl in the car who uses the word fecund.
Yeah.
Just like casually in conversation. And of course, they're listening to Radiohead.
And then misquotes Hamlet.
And misquotes Hamlet and is like, no, excuse me, I think
and
I know my Hamlet.
Misquotes Hamlet. And Cher is like, yeah. And Cher's like, oh no, Mel Gibson did not say that. It was Polonius. And it's just like such a nice, I think that scene was really important to show that Cher actually isn't just completely vapid.
Right.
And that Paul Rudd's character sees that in her and likes that about her, you know?
I would say he doesn't think she's smart. He thinks she's trying to be a good
fair.
Person.
That's fair. Totally.
Because even in the big ending moment where like the sort of jerky lawyer, junior lawyer, like yells at her
yes.
for messing up his pile of papers
yeah.
and she runs upstairs crying, he doesn't say she's not stupid. He says she's trying to help.
Yeah, that's true.
Which is a
right.
difference. But I also think that like it is lovely that he expects more of her, like the Mr. Knightley character. It's not that he's challenging her vapidness for the sake of being mean. He's challenging her
right.
to be better
yeah.
and to watch the news and to
yep.
read a book and to think a little more about the world. But he's also doing it from a only slightly less sheltered point, right? Like the jokes about, oh, has he reached his post-adolescent, you know, sort of like grumpy phase of not thinking anything is I'm trying to remember what Dion says about him early in the movie, but basically calls him out for being like just out of high school. And so
yeah.
thinking he knows more than mm-hmm. everybody in high school.
Mm-hmm. The whole sitting by the pool, reading Nietzsche, trying to grow a goatee guy.
I'm glad he gave up on that goatee.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, in the first scene, he's wearing an Amnesty International t-shirt. So you're like, oh, is he a do-gooder or is he performing? Is he virtue signaling, as we would say now?
One of the reasons that I think the movie is so charming is because, the main antagonist in the movie is Paul Rudd and Alicia Silverstone. That's like the main conflict. And even in that context, it's kind because his critique of her is not you're an idiot, but you're too
right.
smart for this. You're better than this.
Yeah.
You have such ability and intelligence that you shouldn't be devoting yourself to these silly things like trying to fix your friends' lives. There's better things to do with your talents, which is nicer.
It is nicer. Yeah. Let's listen. We've got one more voicemail. This is from Katrina and Nick.
Hi, Nerdette. This is Katrina.
And Nick.
We live in Chicago. I have feelings about Clueless. A, it holds up. It is still great. There are a lot of jokes that I did not get when I was 12 that I get now that I am 37. So well done. Also, this is B for those counting. It is hands down the best film adaptation of Emma ever. I stand by
Thank
that.
Thank you, Katrina.
To be fair, I have not seen the 2019 version, but I still think this is the best adaptation I have ever read or seen.
And yes, it's a great movie. One thing that strikes me is that everybody says that Paul Rudd is an ageless vampire. I think that he's aged 5 years since this movie.
That's fair. That's fair.
It's weird.
And that's what we think. Thanks. Bye.
See, dudes love Paul Rudd too, Peter.
I love that Paul Rudd is maybe in the same universe in my head in this movie as he is in This Is 40. So like there's a fun version in my head of like him being Josh in high school, the character in This Is 40, and I've created sort of an alternate universe that is not canon for that.
The extended Paul Rudd universe.
Just putting that out there.
I was going to say that one thing that they just said is absolutely true, is it really holds up. This is the first
yeah.
of these 90 movies that we've decided to do together, and I was really bracing myself for like very extreme discomfort with the different standards of the 90s and things we thought was funny then that really ain't funny now. But it really does hold up. There's very little of that. We've mentioned one or two of them, but there's not many more. And I think it's partially for the same reason that Austen holds up in a way that some of her contemporaries writing novels in the late 18th, early 19th centuries don't, is that she was writing about such a refined and isolated world that had such little connection to real world concerns that it translates through time. Because even though in Austin's world they're living in country estates, in this world they're living in this fictional version of Beverly Hills High, it's pretty much the same kind of place, and it still exists. And so we can really sort of enjoy it for the same reasons people enjoyed Austin.
Well, and Amy Heckerling spent, I think, weeks, maybe months, in her preparation for this film, hanging out at a Beverly Hills high school to kind of understand the language and some other things. And she said, like, high schoolers, even there, don't dress this fancy to go to school every day. They still sometimes dress up to go to a party, but sometimes just come to school kind of in sweatpants. But beyond that, I think, she was trying to capture, like, a bubble universe that high school often can be for kids who are lucky enough to not have maybe really intense pressures outside of their school life. Then the stakes are who likes who and what are my grades and, you know, those kinds of things, instead of being too concerned with the rest of what's going on in the world. I don't think that teenagers today really have that luxury, if it's a luxury, because, again, I think the internet just sort of forces the outside world into your life much earlier and much more frequently than, you know, you have to choose to watch CNN, whereas I think we're just so immersed in what the outside world looks like. I don't know. Maybe high schoolers can still create this kind of bubble universe for themselves.
Are you asking for a 2020 Clueless remake?
No, it's been done.
No.
Greta didn't like it.
Definitely not. There was a great piece written recently, too, about how it's a movie about Karens.
Oh, really? Interesting.
Like, Cher is a Karen.
Huh.
But it's not a movie that says that if you're a Karen, you're a Karen forever, and so you deserve only bad things.
Yeah. Huh.
Right? It's not a movie that hates Karens. It's one that says that you can put in an effort and be better, which is somebody who is reading a lot of anti-racist literature right now and thinking a lot about social justice and all these things. It is. It's a movie that says wherever you came from, that doesn't have to be where you stay in terms of what you understand about the world and how you interact in the world.
That's really interesting you say that, because wherever you came from, you don't have to stay. Because, again, speaking as someone who just recently read the first 60 pages or so of Emma, one huge difference between the movie Clueless and the book Emma is that Emma, the book and the character, are obsessed with class. Mm-hmm. Because all of her judgments about who belongs with who absolutely have to do with their social class. And sort of class concerns is what you do when you want to do racism, but everybody's the same color. So like this person is no good because they come from too low a rung in society.
Mm-hmm.
And thus you cannot associate with them. And that is almost excised from the movie. When Ty shows up, there are various jokes, including the drug jokes and her accent.
Well, Ty's not allowed to date Travis. Like, she obviously likes him right off the bat.
Right.
And Cher is like, no, you need to be with one of these men.
Right. And that is an absolute.
And Elton says, do you know who my father is? I don't date Ty.
Right. And there is some of that. And in fact, that particular subplot is lifted directly from Emma. Instead of a photograph that Cher takes that he puts in his locker, it's a portrait that Emma paints that he frames and puts over his mantelpiece. And so that plot is there. But the Emma's obsession with class is one of the ugliest things about the character. And
it does come out in Cher. It does come out in Cher when Lucy the maid, says, I don't speak Mexican to her maid. And then Josh, as Paul Rudd's Josh, says, don't say that. That's ignorant. And she's from El Salvador. And she says, well, what difference does it make? And he says, you get mad if people think you live below sunset. Mm-hmm. Which is a funny joke, but also him trying to explain to her the world is bigger than you think it is. And, you know, don't say that to people. And then the movie tries to kind of get away with going like, I apologize to Lucy. Moving on.
I thought that was really interesting that there's like weird VO in the next scene of her being like, after I apologized, I went to the mall.
Oh, that is interesting.
And I don't know.
Maybe
I wonder if
in testing
the movie, they were like, ooh, we need Cher to stay more likable. And even in 1995, telling your maid you don't speak Mexican.
Even if we don't see her apologize, she needs to say she apologized.
Yeah. Yeah.
One thing that's a little odd is the almost entire lack of sex. I mean, the sexiest, dirtiest thing that happens is the scene with the breadstick, where she holds it. That's it.
Oh, yeah.
And by the way, another bit of trivia I found out, they wanted to shoot that in a California Pizza Kitchen, but California Pizza Kitchen looked at that scene with the phallic breadstick and they said, no, that's not what we want to be associated with. Good move, California Pizza Kitchen. And that's kind of, I mean, I think I can say, with even though I'm an old man with some authority, that sexual mores among teenagers is very different now. just from what I've heard.
Well, I think it was different then, too. I mean, you think about a movie like Can't Hardly Wait, which came out not that much later, which is, you know, Seth Green. Seth Green's character, and that is all about getting laid that night.
Yeah, well, that's a very male perspective. There are so many movies about, you know, whether the big dramatic question is whether the male protagonist is finally going to get laid.
Right, right.
And but even I mean, it's kind of like this. I remember reading somebody, a serious British author, who said that whenever she was freaked out about her life, she would read J.R. Tolkien, The Lord of the Rings. And the reason she did is because there's no sex in it at all. It just does. Sex does not exist in that universe. There's, and this is almost the same. It's romance. It's relationships. But it's really just different kinds of. It's like friendship with kissing is what sex is
also,
in this movie.
It is kind of interesting. There's a couple of little moments in there where Dion basically says, I'm technically a virgin, right? And we can all assume what that means. Because she's like, my man is satisfied, but I'm technically a virgin. So that does kind of keep sex in this category of like things girls do for boys.
Yes, also true.
As opposed to things boys and girls and girls and girls and boys do together because it's fun for everybody. It is definitely like sort of referenced as like the thing that girls are deciding whether or not they need to do for the boy in these conversations. But then also they're sitting around talking about things that they like or want to do or not do. And it is showing, I think, like that girls talk about it among themselves, too, not just in reference to boys all the time. This may be, by the way, the only movie in our list that passes the Bechdel test. I'm just thinking about, you know, these three main characters who have conversations about their grades and about their lives and other things besides. They talk about boys a lot.
For people who don't know
about
the Bechdel
just talk about
test,
boys.
Trisha, will you explain it?
So Alison Bechdel, who's a great sort of queer writer and thinker and creator, basically set up a test for watching movies that's, are there at least two women with like names in the film? Do they talk to each other? And do they talk to each other about something other than a romantic interest with a man? I believe is the three prongs of the Bechdel test.
That sounds right to
me. It might not even be a romantic interest thing. I think it might just be about a dude, but regardless.
So
we'll have to keep that going, the assessment, as we watch the rest of these movies.
My guess is Trisha, you're gonna end up disappointed.
It's the 90s, y'all. I did think Vogue, you know, a lot of different outlets did remembrances of Clueless for its 25th anniversary in July, and Keaton Bell for Vogue wrote a great line that I think sums it up pretty beautifully too, which is that it's a glossy teen comedy, biting high school satire, deeply satisfying rom-com, and subversive literary adaptation all at once.
So I'll buy all of that.
Right? I mean, you know, I thought it was just a goddamn pleasure, to be honest.
I really did, too. And the various things I've said to sort of critique it are just sort of like, you know, quibbles. It's a delightful movie. It's a movie about people who are flawed but lovely, made by people who know that they're flawed but lovely. And it appeals, I think, on a really basic level that we've talked about in different ways, which is it's a movie about people ultimately being decent.
It's just nice.
They're just, there's no cruelty in this movie. And we know we don't live in that world, but damn it, it's nice to watch a movie in which you can pretend that. It's like, it's so pretty to think that's what the world is like.
Well, and I don't know, any instance where that behavior is modeled, I think is probably a win, you know?
Yeah. No, but I got no critique of it. I loved it. I just wish the world was more like Clueless in a dumb
way. Totally. Okay, so now that we've watched that delightful, lovely film, next week we're doing Independence Day.
Oh, my gosh.
Yes.
Which I think I saw in the theaters but have not seen since.
I've seen this movie many times.
Really? I do love that we are going from what I still think is primarily a woman's movie to a guy movie. Oh, my God. How much more guy, you know, all these little people with phallic things squirting at each other in the air. Oh, boy.
Gather round and listen while old Peter Sagelman explains this show to you.
Well, on that note, I think we should just call it a day, right?
Yeah, everybody should watch Independence Day.
Watch Independence Day along with us. You can find a full list of movies and episode dates over on our Instagram. Just follow Nerdette Podcast. And of course, you can keep in touch with all of us on Twitter. Trisha is at Trisha Bobita. I am at Greta M. Johnson. And Peter is at Peter Segal. The show is produced by me and Justin Bull. Our executive producer is Brendan Banaszak. And like the most special of thanks to Andrew Edwards of Blue Police Box Music for making yet another amazing theme song for the show. Seriously, it sounds so good. Like, listen to this. It's so great. Also, thanks to Caroline and Marie and Zara and Camila and Bridget and Danny and Katrina and Nick and Jennifer and everyone else who sent us voicemails. This could be you. Just record yourself on your smartphone and then send the audio file to nerdatrecaps@gmail.com. Send them ASAP, especially for your Independence Day ones. But like, if you have very intense Toy Story thoughts right now, just send it over. We want all of them. All right, we will see you next week.
Bye.
Bye.
As if.
Have you ever wondered why anyone drinks Malort? Or if there are actually lobsters in the Chicago River? Then listen to the Curious City podcast, where we answer all your questions about Chicago and the region. WBEZ's Curious City is part of the NPR network and available wherever you find your podcasts.